Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. We're here in the kitchen here at KHOI. We come to you every Tuesday live, and we are lively, too. It is August in Iowa, and we have quite a rainstorm going on today. Today, we'll talk about lots of things. We're going to talk about tomatoes and mozzarella, and we have a special guest in the studio, Margaret Smith, and she's going to be talking about beginning farmers. But first, I want to mention that this radio comes to you as a community radio station. We're all volunteers, and we get by with your good help, your good energy. We have support from the community.
Yes, support comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocery in Ames, community-owned, community-focused since 1974, open daily 7 a.m. to 9 p.m., located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames. Everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op.
And we do, too. So how about this Iowa weather? This is Iowa State Fair time, so of course it's either going to be blistering hot or something's going to happen.
Well, at least it won't be that hot.
Right. So we have buckets of rain today, and things are ripening, but it's going to be quite a challenge. Tomatoes. My tomatoes are sort of treading water now, and this time of year, buckets of rain are not really all that good for tomatoes because tomatoes want to kind of soak up the sunshine and turn into tomatoes as opposed to those little hard green tomato-like objects. This is too much. My tomatoes are kind of splitting and exploding in the field, and it's going to be interesting to see what they look like the rest of this week. There's also elderberries are doing good. I've been fighting the birds for the elderberries, and I got a good batch over the weekend. I cooked some down for some jelly. It is jelly time, and I've been picking ground cherries. We had a recipe last week mentioned. It'll be on our website probably today or real soon for ground cherry pie. I didn't know there was a ground cherry pie, but Mark Rasmussen.
Yes, the director of the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture, and we were talking about ground cherries and tomatillos, which to me, they must be very related, but you farmer ladies told me, no, they're completely separate, so what's the deal?
Margaret Smith is a farmer. What do you know about ground cherries and tomatillos?
Well, not much, but I do know they're related. They're both in the Solanaceae family, which includes...
Solanaceae family.
So that includes tomatoes, ground cherries, tomatillas, eggplant.
That's not terribly related. A ground cherry looks like a small tomatillo. It has that papery thing around.
They both have husks.
Yes, they do. Well, anyway, so Sharon Rasmussen's mother, Grandma Knief, K-N-I-E-F, has a ground cherry pie recipe, which she kindly sent to us. It is 3 cups of husked ground cherries. Now, remember, they're small, like grape or larger.
Yeah, tiny little things.
Yeah, they can be really small, like a grape.
Like a big fat currant, perhaps, or a blueberry size.
Yes, kind of. Yeah. Okay, so you need 3 cups of them, and you have to take the husk and the stem off, slice an apple, 1 cup of sugar, in case they're very tart, 3 tablespoons of flour, 2 tablespoons of butter. Okay, that's all the recipe says. Mix and use your favorite pie crust. Bake 350 until brown. Now, that is my kind of recipe. Okay, remember this. 3 cups of ground cherries, 1 apple, 1 cup of sugar, 3 tablespoons of flour, that's to thicken the juice, and 2 tablespoons of butter. So one would assume you make your pie crust, roll it out, put it in the pan, add this mixture of the ground cherries and flour and sugar, put it in, stick it in the oven at 350 and bake it till it's done.
There you go.
We're going to try it. We'll let you know. And we'll post it on the website.
Yeah. Definitely a grandma recipe. At least you told you how many cups of ground cherries instead of just as much as you like. Yeah.
It's like, what does the garden have to give you? And do you have enough? And go out and get some more if you need some more.
And experience cooks cook by feel.
That's right.
That's kind of
to Mark and Sharon Rasmussen for providing us with the recipe. We are going to... We're going to have some ourselves. Lana's going to have the ground cherries, right?
Yeah, I do have. Do you grow ground cherries, Margaret?
I don't.
Okay. I have grown them. Ground tomatillas was a foreign vegetable to me for a long time. But ground cherries, I remember from grandmas and aunts up in Wisconsin, they always had ground cherries.
And aren't there different colors of ground cherries?
I don't. I'm just familiar with the ones. Regular one.
You've intrigued me now. I want to learn more because we have weedy ground cherries
on
the farm.
Same thing.
You look at them as weeds?
They're weeds.
Yeah. The cultivars are a little bigger. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
This I did not know.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's the same plant.
I've seen some purple ones and some yellow ones. Beth Kemp had some purple ones one year. Delicious.
Are you sure they weren't tomatillas?
We'll check this out and get back to you folks that our expertise is running
time for
short.
Some research. Yeah.
Donna, you just get so excited at your farmer's market, that's the problem.
Okay. Sorry, it's a problem.
Your problem is our gain because we usually end up with fantastic things to eat.
Well, Lana, let's tell them what we're doing today. We have turned the radio station into a kitchen. So you can hear lots of banging and chopping and stirring, and the pepper mill is going to go.
It is. And this is live, folks. This is live. This kind of got inspired by what Donna was talking about. Last time, she was talking, what are you eating now? What's going on? And we were talking about tomatoes. And she mentioned something called a caprese salad. Donna, what is a caprese salad?
Okay. It's just a classic. It's really simple. And it's like something, you know, like when the first tomatoes come in, the really good ones like we're just having now and all the heirlooms. And they're not hothouse tomatoes anymore. They're actually, you know, we've been waiting and growing, and here they are. And what do you do? Well, of course, you do BLTs. And, of course, you do sliced tomatoes on the plate with just a little salt and maybe some olive oil because they're so perfect. But you can also do caprese salad. I mean, it's on menus everywhere, and usually it's awful.
Oh, and the word caprese comes from?
The island of Capri. Very simple. Now, the thing is, in Capri, and where this came from, it was when you had perfect tomatoes and fresh mozzarella. So, we're going to talk about mozzarella, and I have a few kinds here. Now, in Capri, the mozzarella is made with cow because they don't have buffaloes. Now, a typical Italian mozzarella, the really good stuff, is actually made with buffalo milk. So
buffalo, not as in on the open range.
No, water.
Not as in bison.
No,
yes.
Thank you.
Water buffalo. See, Margaret's a scientist. Thank goodness we have this here. And then I also brought some fresh cow mozzarella. I'm opening the package. You know, now mozzarella is like the buffalo comes packed in water. And there's a third thing, which I tried to get at Wheatsfield last night, and they were all sold out, which is called, where's my kitchen towels? I know, I brought them. I'm getting all messy. Oh, here they are.
So, Donna, just one thing I'm remembering from the buffalo milk is the buffalo are often a multi-purpose piece of livestock. They're used, type of livestock, that they're used for draft, for tillage, and then they're milked, and the milk is made into mozzarella.
Oh. Yeah. And lots of, like in India, they make a lot of buffalo milk. All right, now, just visually, I've just cut up the cow mozzarella and the buffalo mozzarella, ladies. Now, look, see how the buffalo mozzarella has this little skin around it, whereas the cow mozzarella is just like pretty much the same consistency all the way through. Now, these are good, even the cow one is Crave Brothers fresh mozzarella from Wisconsin. The thing is, a lot of mozzarella is just like rubber.
Yeah, that's my response to it. It's this white stuff.
Right. So you want to do, Lana, can you tear me off a couple of, the classic caprese is, this is great. I didn't bring any, all right, we're going to do it on the cutting board. So I'm taking a rather larger round tomato, and you just kind of want to slice the tomato maybe a little thicker than the cheese. And what you do typically is, okay.
And Donna, do you always leave the skin on?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Especially for a caprese. So on your platter, what you're doing is you're layering the, you know, kind of so you see like a little crescent of cheese and then a tomato and then another crescent of cheese. And in typical fashion, they actually stick a whole basil leaf in there like that. So then you put a little salt. I'm sprinkling the salt on.
So, Donna, this is really beautiful. I just want to describe it's sort of fanned out with the tomato overlapping the cheese and then the cheese overlapping the next piece of tomato. Red, that's not a vertical stack.
No.
Right.
And then I'm just putting pepper on. Now, you drizzle with a little olive oil, like just pour it. Drizzle. Drizzle is the word. Now it's going to get really messy because I'm not on a plate. But here's the thing with a lot of Caprese salads in restaurants and other places. They put vinegar on it.
Oh,
even
really?
Balsamic vinegar. This is not classic, okay?
Okay, no, take note of this, folks.
I mean, it's not that. If your mozzarella is lousy and your tomatoes aren't perfect, that's what people do. I personally would prefer to not eat it at all if I can't have good mozzarella. Now, first of all, I want you each to take a taste of the buffalo mozzarella with the little skin on it and then compare it to the cow mozzarella. Now, remember, both of these are actually good quality mozzarella.
Oh, the buffalo mozzarella. I like the buffalo because it's, mm-hmm. it has a taste. The cow mozzarella is kind of mild to the point of being rather insipid. It has a nice texture.
That's the buffalo.
A nice texture.
It's softer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But
Margaret? It doesn't have exactly the chewy texture we're used to for mozzarella.
I think we're used to mozzarella
texture.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, mozzarella is a fresh cheese, mm-hmm. just like ricotta or goat mm-hmm. cheese. Or it's actually very easy to make in your own home.
You just need your own buffalo.
Yes, or your own cow
or goat.
Now there's a third way of making mozzarella. I'm going to just cut this a little bit so you guys can taste it. Here, dig in. Here's some spoons. Okay, and taste it. That has both kinds of mozzarella in them. But you see why it's easy. How long mm-hmm. did that take? Nothing. Now, there's a third kind of mozzarella called burrata, which is, it's cow's milk, but it's closer to the texture of the buffalo, and it's some technique where they make a skin out of the milk, the thicker part, and then they scoop some of the less firm mozzarella inside it. So you end up with this little purse with this creamy, very creamy mozzarella on the inside of it. And when you cut it, it kind of creams out all over, and it's even more tender than the buffalo.
Oh, and give us the name of that.
Burrata. Burrata.
Oh, that sounds pretty lovely.
I did see some at Wheatsfield, and I meant to bring it in, but it was all sold out. So I went looking at other stores around town and could find none.
This is delicious, Donna. Delicious, Donna.
See how easy
fresh,
it is?
Well, fresh basil, of course, sparks up everything, but it's...
Yeah.
It's
There's your
lovely.
Caprese salad.
It's lovely.
And you should only eat it this time of year.
Well, that makes sense.
Once you've had it so good, why else would you want to eat it?
It's nice to have because I have had things look like this out of season, and it's not the same.
Exactly.
So, yes,
exactly.
The fresh tomato will do it for you every time.
And people put it on menus because it is very attractive.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's very childlike and simple. I mean, mozzarella cheese is like, everybody likes mozzarella cheese. What's not to like? It's like mother's milk, practically.
That's true.
So simple.
But I'm impressed. Salt and pepper and olive oil.
Yeah, and skip the vinegar. That's, okay. if you see a recipe, an entree in a restaurant and it has vinegar on it, don't even order it because you'll know that the vinegar's just covering up the lack of quality ingredients. And don't try to eat it except when tomatoes are in season.
Oh, it's like squeezed corn or strawberries. Go for it.
Exactly.
Go for it. So how are the tomatoes doing on your farm, Margaret?
Well, we don't raise them commercially, but
I mean,
in the garden.
I have them in the garden.
They're doing great. I must admit, they were planted a little late. And so they've just been coming in about the last week. I've got cherry tomatoes. I've got heirlooms. I also have... just a small chicken flock, 10 chickens that roam around. And a friend of mine said, don't your chickens bother your tomatoes? I said, no, no, they're fine, until I started looking around the base of the tomato plants, and I find these little hollowed-out shells of tomatoes. So they're getting to the ripest ones first. I feel a little bad about that.
But you have very happy chickens.
Oh, they're very happy.
So on your farm, it's the tomatoes that are being eaten by the chickens, and I know it's chipmunks that get some of mine, but I figure we can all share. It's the ones on the ground that are.
There's enough for all. I plant 16 tomato plants a year because we made 16 tomato cages. And if I didn't have something limiting me, I would plant 50 tomato plants. And I don't need 50. So the 16 tomato cages are my delimiter.
Well, if you only have 10 chickens, I mean, I think you'd be fine. How many tomatoes
that's
can
what
a
that's,
chicken
that's
eat?
That's what I'm saying. We've got plenty of tomatoes. Plenty.
The chickens would probably like the mozzarella, too.
They can't have it.
Oh, okay. Okay. Do you have any other tomato advice this time of year, Donna?
Well, you were talking about how difficult the rain is for the tomatoes.
At least for ours. It's hitting our flock of tomatoes at the wrong time. It's just we've had a great crop for the couple weeks.
So they're starting to split?
Yeah, yeah.
And what are you doing? Picking them
green? And picking them as early as I can. Not green, but...
won't split while they're green, right?
Yeah, yeah. I was out there this morning and it started to thunder and I thought, oh dear, my obituary will read, woman gets struck by lightning while picking brandy wines. You know, in this case, I was trying to save them. So the people that are growing tomatoes in undercover are actually doing quite well this week. So we'll
Lana,
see.
Lana, had you been watering them during the dry period?
No. The summer is, we usually run an irrigation line and always usually have to at least once a week. This has been a wet summer and a cool summer. So there are challenges. Things that are good, weather that's good for some folk is not good for other folks. So the tomatoes are interesting. What you got there, Donna?
Well, if you have too many splitting tomatoes, what do you do? Throw them in the pot and cook them down and freeze them or roast them? I do a lot of tomato jam.
A lot of oven roasted tomatoes and a lot of dried tomatoes.
Waste not, want not.
Oh, it's just fine. I try not to waste any of them, but yeah. Yeah. So.
Well, I wanted to talk to Margaret about beginning farmers. Because, Margaret, tell us, aside from being an organic farmer, with your husband and Doug Allert, where is it?
Ashgrove Farm is in Franklin County, which is straight north of Ames, about 60 miles. Our county seat is Hampton, and we live 5 miles south of town.
And Margaret and I got to know each other very well from being on the Iowa Organic Association Board for many, many years. But Margaret has a professional life at ISU Extension, so this is Dr. Margaret Smith. Tell us what you're working on now.
I've been working for Extension, yes, for many years, almost 30, but I work in the value-added agriculture program, and I'm just going to, just starting this fall, working with a beginning farmer new grant that Iowa State has received. It's a beginning farmer research and development grant that's issued by USDA. In part because we know a lot of beginning farmers are going to need to do value-added enterprises to make it.
All right. I understand that. And tell us why.
Well, we have farmers who go back to family businesses and will start working with parents or grandparents. But we have a lot of people interested in farming who don't have a land base or a business to go back to. And they are starting from scratch.
Okay. So there are the kids who are to the farm born, so to speak, so they can continue growing, the row crops because they have access to land. Okay, now, beginning farmers, unless they have a lot of money from something else, have trouble getting enough land to become a farmer, right?
And let me just add a little bit to that, Donna, is if your family farmed and they have a land base, perhaps they have machinery, you may have the opportunity to go back and join that operation, but it's not as easy as some people may think.
Well, because
there are relationships.
Multiple families
have to make
derive a living, income.
Have to make a living. Often, if the generation interval, if parents are only 25 years older than the young beginning farmer, parents might only be 40 or 45 when the young person's coming back and going, I want to farm.
Might even be grandparents.
And the parents are still, the grandparents may still be farming. So it's not always easy. The size of the farm, the selection of the enterprises.
And the number of children in every generation.
The number of children, what the commodity prices may be if you're raising a commodity during the time you want to start. So in the last two
commodity
years.
Commodity being corn and soybeans.
Corn and soybeans, undifferentiated hogs and undifferentiated cattle, we would say are commodities.
Tell us what undifferentiated means, Margaret.
Well, that's almost redundant with commodity. It means that when the product leaves your farm, no one knows where it came from. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have your identity.
Right.
So a bushel of corn is a bushel of corn is a bushel of corn. That's
a
commodity.
And a pig is a pig. It's not like humanely raised or Berkshire this.
There's nothing to distinguish it from other pigs.
Just goes to the regular old meat packing plant.
In the commodity stream.
Yeah.
And so the economics of commodity production is that the cost of production tends to rise to the price. So in commodity production, some people are producing right about it costs them to produce what it costs, what they're getting for selling. They're breaking even.
So no matter how high the commodity goes, the price goes up too.
The price goes up too.
And because the grain price will grow up
Right. So there's variation in commodity prices. And let's just let's just say grain. So in before 5 years ago, grain prices in Iowa, corn and soybean, were very high. And so there's a lag when grain prices go up for various reasons, world markets, weather conditions, whatever. There's a lag in that the cost of inputs will follow and rise as well.
Cost of inputs would be?
Land rent.
Uh-huh.
Fuel.
Uh-huh.
Price of seed.
Uh-huh.
Pesticides that may be applied.
And fertilizers.
And fertilizers. So after a few years, so if grain prices go up, farmers are very happy. They tend to make some nice profits in those years. But the prices of those inputs will rise to where they're just about breaking even again. Now, in the last 2 years, grain prices have gone down. So for a number of farmers, they're upside down. If you remember the upside down in land rents that contributed to that housing crisis. Some farmers are upside down in that right now it's going to cost them more to grow their grains than they're going to get by marketing them.
I want to take a little opportunity here to say that this is KHOI, and we're talking to Margaret Smith about how in the world can someone become a beginning farmer?
There's a lot of things to consider. Next generation into farming.
We'll take a little music break here. This is the band called Kale Sur. They will be performing in Ames for the KHOI birthday celebration on Sunday. Kale Sur, music from Chile. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We've been talking about mozzarella and tomatoes, and we're also talking about beginning farmers. And we're talking today in the studio with Margaret Smith.
So Margaret was explaining, first of all, actually, we should preface this with saying, and I hope you know the statistics, in the next 15 years, we are going to have some sort of, 60 or 70% of existing farmers retire, and or pass on and land in Iowa and all throughout the Midwest, like substantial amounts of land, will actually change hands.
And I didn't come with that statistic today, Donna. I apologize.
Well,
I apologize.
It's high. Unprecedented amount.
Yeah,
it's something like a society that we have not been through before.
I think your number might be high, but it doesn't matter because you're right. It's that a high percentage of land will turn over. So some of that will turn over to children and grandchildren who will want to farm. A lot of it gets passed on to children, many of whom are not living in Iowa, but will rent it to farmers. And then some of it gets sold. And that
to
is
a land developers or larger.
No, typically most land sales are to other farmers. That's statistically who buys most farmland in Iowa.
And does this mean what kind of farmers? Not your small family farming enterprises.
No, they are typically family farms that are expanding, and some of those are becoming quite large.
Define quite large in Iowa.
5 to 10,000 acres.
Ah! Okay. Okay. Fortunately, I think we do have some laws in Iowa that limit out-of-state corporations from – I'm really in over my head. But I know that there's – you know, there are states where – here's the thing. There's internationally a thing going on called land grabs, where – particularly where countries who do not have enough agriculture to feed their people, like Saudi Arabia, China – even the U.S. is doing it, like land grabs in, say, Africa. But a lot of foreign countries are actually buying American farmland, too. It is an investment of the future.
Well, and some are just independent foreign investors. I know, mm-hmm. I know the – and again, I don't have this data off the top of my head. I apologize. But I know that there is some foreign land investment in Iowa. It's a very small percentage of the land. It is increasing, but it's very small, less than 5%.
Nevertheless, I think it would be wise if we could train our own young people. So Margaret's working on that. So tell us some of the initiatives that are helping to bring a new younger, and by younger generation, we're talking like 40 and under, more or less?
Yeah, I would say 40 and under.
That's young and farming.
Just to make the leap from what we were talking about, why it's even difficult for young people from farms to go back and farm, all the constraints to that. Some people have no land base. They didn't come from a farm. I really love that. I know a number of beginning farmers who had liberal arts college degrees and really got turned on to food and agriculture through that. It's very exciting to me. But they have no place to go. They are starting from scratch. No land, no equipment. They will
no family training.
No family training. So most of them will work on farms to get that experience. Mm-hmm. I've interviewed a number of these, and they'll work up to 2 years on other farms, and not just one. They'll often want to go from farm to farm to farm.
Right.
But because of difficulty of access to land, there's a social psychological fact of farmers is once they get their hands on land or they're able to farm it, they don't like to give it up.
Okay. Yes, and I can understand why.
Right. I mean, it's valuable, whether you own it or whether you have access to it. It's valuable.
Well, and once you've you know, it's a little like ownership of a home. Any major thing that you live in and you take care of, you become a steward for,
and you're very attached to it. There's
an
emotional attachment. Now, there's less emotional.
In a good way.
Yeah, there's less emotional attachment to rented land, but sometimes even that. So, many of those beginners who do not have access to land are not people who are going to say, I'm going to start farming, I'm going to raise corn and soybeans, and I'm going to put up a big hog building. Typically, they look at something that's more management intensive, perhaps labor intensive, and less land intensive for all these reasons.
Right.
So they've got brains and they've got brawn if they're young. They may not have much money or capital, and they have no land. So they have to go out and find the capital, save it, make it another job, maybe start farming and maintain another job. And so they have to get access to at least a few acres. So many of these are starting with, again, high-value crops like vegetables, some fruits. And a third popular enterprise mix for beginning farmers is direct marketing meats, where they might need 10 to 40 acres.
Basically pigs, cows,
pigs,
lambs,
cattle, sheep,
chickens,
broilers, and eggs.
Uh-huh.
So that mix again, and sometimes with vegetables, is a popular mix for beginners. So, again, they're looking for something they can use their management. They can use their savvy and expertise. Many, many, many of them have college degrees or advanced degrees.
But not necessarily in agriculture?
Not necessarily in agriculture, but something that requires less land.
So what is this grant doing for them? How are you starting them out?
So the new grant that Iowa State has received is focused on several factors affecting beginning farming and family farm transitions. So one aspect we will be...
Tell us what a family farm transition is.
This is transitioning the farm business to typically a younger generation. So the transition involves transition of capital, transition of management and decision-making, and ultimately infrastructure, buildings,
use a little example that I saw a couple of weeks ago in Van Horn. It's the Franzenberg family, where there was the corn and soybean growing, and then the next generation came along, and I'm not sure, but I would say they're about 45 or so. So they're already raising their kids, too. But when the Franzenbergs, Anne and her husband started to come back to his family farm, they did all kinds of value-added products, like growing herbs that they could sell. And now they've settled down to, Anne has some hothouses, and she grows, you know, vertical. She's got tomatoes, cucumbers, eggplants, and she has a large cut flower business.
So
that's taking the land that was already in the family, but producing kind of another job for the next generation to do.
You picked a perfect example of what can be done and has been done. So Eric and Ann Franzenberg, exactly as you said, Eric's parents raised corn, soybeans, and commodity hogs, just undifferentiated hogs. Mm-hmm. They farrowed to finished hogs. Mm-hmm. And Eric went back and said, if we can't expand this land base, and my understanding is they've not. Mm-hmm. They're maybe farming 300 to 400 acres. You're right. He added all these other enterprises, and they've made a wonderful living for their family using their brains.
Yeah, now, a lot of experimentation.
A lot of experimentation. They did have to bring in extra capital as they built their greenhouses, as they built drying.
That's starting a whole other
drying
business.
Sheds, starting a whole other business. But, yeah, extremely impressive and certainly can be done.
Well, I also want to mention that in Iowa – in addition to the ISU extension work that Margaret is doing and telling us about, and she's working closely with Practical Farmers of Iowa, has a big beginning farmers program, and also Women, Food, and Agriculture has been contributing. So we have three really strong organizations that are kind of coordinating efforts to help this farm transition.
In addition, Farm Bureau has started a new program in the last few years, and Farm Bureau's very large organization in Iowa with a lot of farmer members, particularly working with...
It's a big hot issue right now, and we all need to...
And their program is helping with family farm transition, less so with someone who's going to do a new startup.
So your grant is, okay, you're helping them to get financial training.
Well, business planning training, we'll do courses offered in that.
This is through ISU Extension.
Through Iowa State Extension. Uh-huh. We will be offering training to help prepare farm transition specialists. So people who may already be working farmers, lawyers.
Professionals like lawyers
bankers,
who write wills, bankers who structure inheritance and tax information.
Extension advisors. So we're going to provide training for them to help them be better advisors for these families.
Right. We need a lot of options.
Mm-hmm. We are organizing a series of young farmer peer support groups. So to date, we actually already have 10 of those around the state. Most of those focused for young livestock producers so they can share ideas, production ideas.
This is all support. Kinds of livestock.
And we'll be, with the new grant, we'll be starting some of these with horticulture farmers as well, so vegetable and fruit producers.
That is really an important thing. Speaking as a farmer who started, I have a very small farm.
But you have mentored a lot of market gardeners.
That's what I wanted to mention. I started out as a gardener that sort of slid into a small farm operation about 18, 20 years ago. It's amazing what you have to know. You mentioned that you don't necessarily need an agriculture degree, but oh, I don't know, a degree in fine art wasn't too bad. There's so many and it's so many things you learn from your neighbors. There's
you
a lot
to
a
know
lot of
how
things.
You need to know how to learn,
yes.
And you need to know how to find people who know what you don't.
Very much. The concept of neighboring is probably one of the most important things. I don't know. Can you teach that? Can you get a grant for that? That is probably the most important thing. So what you learn from people that are already doing what you want to do is really helpful.
I think farming is a lot like cooking. You know, people go to cooking school, just like you go to agriculture school. And I've worked with a lot of young people who have come out of cooking school and don't know anything. It's cooking and farming are very hands-on, and traditionally these are crafts and skills that have been passed down through apprenticeships, oral tradition. Kids grow up on the farm and they know how to farm.
Mm-hmm.
Kids cook, you know, go through an apprenticeship program.
And then you learn how to peel
potatoes.
And you're
in the kitchen and you start by washing dishes and peeling potatoes.
Yeah.
But that progresses, and that's the best way to learn these kinds of skills.
The other nice thing about that is even though you have and we certainly in international agriculture we'd call that indigenous knowledge,
mm-hmm.
right? But it's indigenous knowledge in the U.S. as well.
Absolutely.
But new techniques come along and farmers invent new techniques, and so there's that sharing as well. We don't do everything the way our parents did.
No.
And the way our grandparents did it. So there's the innovation sharing as well. Practical Farmers does such a superb job of helping link people and do that.
Practical Farmers of Iowa, yes.
And we're hoping that these peer farmer support groups supplement that and complement that to do even more of that. So they come physically together every so often. These tend to be geographically based.
Yeah.
So it's not just
a big state, 99 counties.
It's not just a virtual
right.
support group.
Yes, it's the things we can learn from one
from
another.
From our neighbors.
From one another. Yes. I'd like to mention that we are listening to KHOI 89.1 FM, Story City in Ames. Also, I want to mention that this fine radio station has been around for 3 years. We're going to celebrate a birthday. And we have this birthday party coming up. It's going to happen on Sunday, August 23rd. You can go to the website, khoifm.org, and find out about it. And you are all invited. Here's a little bit about celebrating birthdays. It always brings to mind cakes. I like birthday cakes. Speaking of birthday cakes, KHOI is going to have a birthday real soon. KHOI has been around for 3 years, and I think celebrating is a good thing to do. One of the things that we do to celebrate is have a birthday cake every now and then. And if somebody knows a good recipe, oh, they are most welcome, most welcome. We have someone that has a really good recipe for a birthday cake. Beth Kemp is in the studio with us today. Tell us about your birthday cake.
Oh, this one is my favorite. It's a red wine chocolate cake. It is incredibly moist, and you don't really taste the wine, but it adds something. You know how wine and vinegars tend to deepen flavors? I feel like this does the same thing mm-hmm. with the chocolate. So it's actually quite a simple, almost old-fashioned style recipe. It's got loads of buttermilk. It has...
Oh, that's why it's so moist.
Yes, mm-hmm. loads of buttermilk. It has almost a cup of red wine, and they call for a sweet red wine, but I've used all sorts of different leftover wines that I have. Sometimes I'll freeze a little bit of what's in the bottom of my bottle of red wine that I don't
right,
finish.
Right, because you don't want it to turn into vinegar.
Exactly. Yep, and then I can just pull that out and do that. And it's got coffee. Just has layers and layers of flavor. It's just so moist and delicious. We can post the recipe online. And I like to frost it with a very... a frosting that isn't too sweet. Sometimes you could just use whipped cream if you wanted, or I don't know, any kind of light, fluffy, not too sweet frosting. I like I think it's called a butter roux frosting. I'm not positive, but it's almost like a roux. You know how you take milk and you'll cook it with flour, and it makes like a thick. Almost like a gravy.
So it's not butter; it's milk and flour.
Yeah, it's milk. Well, this is how I do the frosting. I cook milk and flour together on the stove until mm-hmm. it's thick like a pudding, right? And then in a separate bowl, you cream together softened butter and just regular granulated sugar, and then I put I dollop the sort of pudding, the flour, milk, thick mixture.
Cooled.
Cooled, yes. You cool that, and you dollop that into the whipped butter and sugar, and you continue to whip, and it just turns light and fluffy.
That, you're using an electric mixer.
Yes, I'm using an electric mixer. You could use a hand electric mixer, too. I wouldn't want to do it
by whisk.
Yeah, that would give you way too big of a bicep. But you just, you layer that into this red wine chocolate cake, and it is divine.
Oh, well, I don't have a birthday coming up for a long time, Beth, but I will remind you when it's getting near again.
I love making birthday cakes.
Good.
You're a good person, Beth. So that was the red wine chocolate cake with a whipped roux fluffy frosting.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. Very good. Thank you, Beth. We're back. That was a fine bit of talk about a possible birthday cake. Make yourself
a
birthday
cake. And the recipe will post on the website.
The recipe will be on the website, the cake and the frosting. It would be called Beth's Red Wine Chocolate Cake. Yes, we're back here in the studio with a whole studio full of peaches and...
Yes, and we're cooking in the studio today.
And we're here also with Margaret Smith, who knows her way around a kitchen, too, and a farm. She's talking to us about beginning farmers. Donna, what you're making noise. What are you doing,
I've
Donna?
I just whipped up a little, I'm going to call it a yellow tomato salsa, but I hope you weren't watching because it has a little surprise in it. And I want you to taste it, Margaret. And then we have a new invention for radio. I want you to smell this, everybody. Now, we're turning on the Rick the engineer is turning up the smell factor on the radio. Anybody who can smell this, I want you to call us immediately and tell us what you think. Have a taste, Lana. Margaret, what do you think of this?
Well, I know two ingredients that went in. It's good. It's just mildly, mildly sweet, but not much. It's really more savory than sweet.
Yes.
So the secret ingredient I'm thinking is basil.
No, the secret is, see, it's yellow. You serve it in like a yellow tomato salsa.
Yeah.
But it's peaches and tomatoes.
I saw that go in.
Yes, you did. So it's not so secret, but if you're just serving it, people look at it and they don't really see the peaches. In fact, you can make slightly more tomatoes than peaches. And it gets even more, and cut them even smaller.
It's very subtle.
Yeah, but it's wonderful served over chicken or even as a salad. Or you could even put that over the mozzarella.
And did you add anything else to that?
Salt, pepper, and some of Lana's opal basil.
Opal basil, okay.
That's it. And I just keep encouraging people to mix peaches and tomatoes. What do you think, Lana?
I think it's wonderful. I like it any time that... Tomatoes are a different color but red, and it's a really pretty color.
Yeah, and it's always somehow miraculously in the grand scheme of things, peaches and tomatoes are ripe at the same time of year. So I think that's a sign that these should be combined.
And the ingredients for this sort of thing are just the sort of things that can be grown in Iowa. And I know we don't get peaches all the
right,
time.
Right. No, this was actually a Colorado peach, which are in town a lot now and at the marvelous price this year of $1.48 in several different supermarkets around town.
Oh, and good eye.
The Missouri peaches are still around, too, which are excellent.
There are some peaches from southern Iowa, but their winter hardiness limits us. Yeah. For instance, I've tried to plant them where I live. 60 miles north of Ames, and they promptly die.
Yeah, it's pretty.
Helen
pretty
Gunderson busy. Grows peaches in Ames.
In a backyard, or if you have a little microclimate,
microclimate.
You can put something in, and you have to have a good heart to do that. And live a clean
it's
life.
It's risky.
Yeah, it's risky.
I have to tell you, I tried again because I planted another peach tree this summer.
Oh, good for you. Good for
New
you.
New variety has come out since the last time
it's
I planted.
It's slightly hardier, maybe?
Yes, I had planted a Reliance peach years ago that died, and I planted a Contender. I don't know if it's that much more winter hardy, but we're going to find out.
Does it help if it, like, goes on the south side of the barn or anything like
yes,
that?
Yes, if it's protected from microclimate. Mine is inside of a windbreak, south of a windbreak.
Okay. And, well, good luck, Margaret.
Well, the challenge is
it can also
live for 4 or 5 years, and then you get a hard winter. It can go.
But, oh, yeah.
But that's part of the fun of gardening.
Well, I've lost a lot of things with some hard winters. Yeah. Now, we have one more kitchen experiment. Margaret has told me, what's the new thing you're growing this year, Margaret?
My new thing I've never grown before is a tomatilla. I just planted one plant, and one is plenty because it's ginormous. It's probably 7 feet tall and 7 feet wide.
And Lana is growing them. You're going to hear me ripping the husk off of the tomatillo because that's what you have to do. Lana is an experienced tomatilla grower.
I didn't grow up with tomatillas, and so they're always a surprise. But this is my best tomatilla year ever. What do you do with tomatillas, Margaret?
No, I'm waiting for you guys to tell me because they're sitting on the vine.
She's never
sitting on the vine. Right.
Explain to her when she should pick them, Lana.
Please.
Well, you could use them
when they're ripe, right?
You can, even when they're small.
Right. When you can squeeze that little paper husk and it's full of something when it's hard, yeah. There's going to be a little give in there, but let the tomatilla fill the space. And you can use them when they're green, but if you let them hang on the vine, they will get a little softer, a little sweeter, a little more golden.
So this Lana has really large tomatillas this year, which are just beautiful. You think that in time these will get golden? They're very green now.
Yeah.
But they're not that hard.
So this is 2.25 inches in diameter. This is a very large tomatilla.
Yeah,
and mine are all smaller than this.
That's the variety.
Mine are all smaller than this
point. Yeah. That's soft enough to...
It's pretty firm. So yeah, it's firmer than a tomato.
Yeah, but it still has some give to it. So I did tell Margaret, here's the thing about tomatillas. You have to cook them. It's not like a tomato.
Right. And surprisingly, if you cut them apart.
Mm-hmm. They look sort of tomato,
tomatoes. But they're very dense on the inside. You can see little tomato tomatilla seeds in there. But it doesn't look like the inside of a tomato with those pockets of juicy things happening. It's pretty solid looking.
So I have a mixture that I cooked up at home. And Margaret, you're going to taste this and you'll get all I did was kind of quarter or slice the tomatillas and put a little olive oil or some kind of fat into a pan and saute them with onions, salt, pepper, and basil. Same thing I've been using on everything else today. What do you think? So it makes a salsa in the sense of sauce. Mm-hmm. It can certainly be used in Mexican food. We had a dinner the other day where I just cooked up some hamburgers and piled this on top of it, and they were really good. Have a taste, Lana.
It's very good. I like it. It's tart. I'm getting the tart from the tomatilla.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Yeah. So there's no lemon in it. No, it's just the tomatilla, the onion. You could add garlic, but the flavor of the tomatilla, like a tomato, is delicate enough. You don't want to really overwhelm them. You could also roast them. They're wonderful. Split them in half, roast them in the oven with a little olive oil, salt, and pepper. Or, like in this instance, for the sauté, you know how to cook them when they fall apart. And it cooks about as long as the onion needs to cook as well. So, very simple. I'm sure your boys and your husband will enjoy this.
One never knows with teenage boys
what
they will enjoy.
It's not an alien
flavor. It's not that
flavor.
Strange.
No, and it doesn't really look so much like a vegetable. It looks like, you know.
Like salsa.
Yeah. And on a hamburger, it goes down.
There we go. We'll call it salsa.
So, there you have it. What to do with tomatillos.
That's great because I have hundreds coming on.
Well, just remember, you can, you can just spray the cookie sheet. Cut them in half, spread them out, roast them, a little salt and pepper, and then you can always, after that, throw them in baggies and freeze them.
And Lana, if I were to dry the tomatillo, would I make thin slices like quarter-inch slices?
I have just done that this year because I decided, I can do that with tomatoes. I made thin little coin-sized slices.
You dry them raw?
Dry them raw.
And what do you do with them then?
I put them in airtight jars, and it's going to be great to add to things, especially stir fries. And I add that sort of thing to soups a lot.
Oh, okay. So you cook them later then.
Cook them later. And even if you could use them as a, you could serve them at a party because they're these little coins, and they're very tart lemon, not lemon either, tomatillo-y, but they're a really tart sort of thing,
so
even dry.
Dried, uncooked, you can
no,
do that.
No, I like this idea. I just bought a new dryer at the end of last summer.
Oh, play around with it.
Yeah.
Yes, it's fine.
Great.
It's fine. Well, do we have any other good positive things going on with the Beginning Farmers Program you would like to mention?
Well, there is one other thing we want to work on that is there's an underserved audience. We talked about this difficulty of accessibility to land, yet we know there's a lot of land in Iowa, 23 or 24 million acres farmed, and some of it's being passed to children in-state and out-of-state. So we're going to make an effort to contact more of these landowners, farmers who are still maybe living on the farm but don't have a successor, and try to facilitate some matching.
So you have willing young farmers for people who will want to eventually rent to them. Is that the idea?
This is what we're trying to match up. And we are looking at what other states have done. We're looking at what Practical Farmers of Iowa has done. This particular activity is very challenging to do. There's one thing about finding people, but there's often geographic preferences. So there are personality matches you may want.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There are financial needs that the retirees or the inheritees, I just made up a word, the people who inherit the land.
Inheritors.
Thank you.
Thank you. Something like that. I was an
may
English
have.
Major.
So it's very challenging to make this match. In a family farm transition, there's often, of course, capital that's transferred.
You should have dating services.
Absolutely.
Matchmaking services.
E-Farmony.
I've already got this worked out. We like that. Good idea, Margaret.
So there's a lot of work to be done there, and we don't know exactly how all to do it, but we're going to be learning. We're going to spend several years learning how to do this better because the opportunity
is there.
So
this is part of ISU Extension. Yeah, probably a very important part.
It's a very important part. And
if anybody wants to find out more about this, is there a website or contact?
We do not have a website yet because the grant is new, but they could go to the Beginning Farmer website at Iowa State Extension and find out the programs that we do have ongoing.
Keep an eye on it for what Margaret's going to come up with next.
We'll be adding to that website.
Thank you for talking to us about that. That's wonderful, knowing who's going to be on the land in the future and someone who has a good feel. Yes, people will find what they want to do. This is good. I want to remind you of KHOI's birthday coming up. Is a party going on, a 3 o'clock lecture at the First United Methodist Church, August 23rd, 3 o'clock. And then, do take this
in. Wait, who's the lecturer?
Nicholas Johnson, Iowa's own former FCC commissioner. Yes, he's going to be talking at 3 o'clock at the First United Methodist Church.
I think I'll attend.
And then, after that, 4:30, a birthday party at Bar La Tosca on Main Street and Calle Sur. The band
whose
that
music
you heard,
we heard earlier heard, sounds wonderful.
It'll be at 4:30, so come to a birthday party. 3 years we have survived the terrible twos, so we are up and rolling as a radio
FCC
station.
FCC commissioner
here.
Should have. There's a lot going on with the FCC. It should be interesting.
And speaking of birthdays, this is the birthday of the Central Iowa Barn Dance. We've been doing the Central Iowa Barn Dance in this town for 25 years.
Dancing, dancing, dancing.
So there. We're going to go out with some music from the Barn Owl Band. This is the house band, the Central Iowa Barn Dance. And there's a barn dance this weekend. Go to CIBD.org. On Saturday, there's a barn dance. Yes, there is. Right here at Ames. Look for Central Iowa Barn Dance.org. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We've been talking about all sorts of tomatoes and things and mozzarella cheese. We've been talking with Margaret Smith about the Beginning Farmers Program and tomatillas. We had music today by Calle Sur.
Come see them at Bar La Tosca.
And come hear the Barn Owl Band on Saturday night, the 22nd, at the Barn Dance. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is KHOI Radio. Go to the website for recipes and more about us and more about the birthday party. KHOIFM.org. That's the website. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We have engineering by Rick Morrison. Eat good food. Enjoy life.